Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN General Assembly was expected to adopt a resolution on Wednesday calling on the International Court of Justice, ICJ, to rule on countries' legal obligations related to climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told country representatives in New York that they were making history with their resolution. For those on the front lines already paying the price for global heating they did nothing to cause, climate justice is both a vital recognition and a tool, Mr. Guterres said, explaining that it offered recognition that all people on our planet are of equal worth while also promoting resilience against spiraling climate impacts. The Pacific Island state Vanuatu, on the front lines of the climate crisis, proposed the resolution, which would move the world closer to establishing a legal basis for climate justice. Just last week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, said the time to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels was quickly running out. The number of conflict-related deaths worldwide increased by a staggering 46% from 2020 to 2021, the World Health Organization, WHO, said on Wednesday. In its alert, the UN Health Agency also explained that a heavy burden of injury and disability accompanied the spike in the number of people killed. This is believed to be because the tactics and weaponry of modern warfare have evolved, causing more and more complex injuries to civilians, while health workers lack access to training and basic medical supplies to treat them. Here's Dr. Rick Brennan, Emergency Director of the WHO Eastern Mediterranean Region, speaking from Cairo.
For every death, we could expect at least 4 to 10 other injuries, many of which leave people with lifelong disabilities, particularly among young people.
Dr. Brennan also said that up to 80% of trauma deaths in the region occur before victims reach hospital. Improving basic services such as transportation and first aid could save at least a quarter of those lives. WHO called for more investment in healthcare staff in the region to build trauma care pathways from pre-hospital settings to the emergency room, surgery, and rehabilitation. The use of terrorism charges against anti-government protesters must stop in Colombia, UN-appointed independent human rights experts said on Wednesday. The group of experts, which includes the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights While Countering Terrorism, Fionnuala Ney Alowin, said the use of such egregious charges had a chilling effect on protest movements in the country and threatened fundamental freedoms. According to information received by the experts, 228 individuals who took part in mass protests against tax hikes in 2021 in Colombia have been charged with offenses including terrorism and conspiracy to commit crimes. Some also face lengthy prison terms. The experts said that although they recognize the state's responsibility to respond to violence, violent individuals among peaceful demonstrators must be dealt with fairly and in accordance with international human rights standards. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Lay your hands on the radio. Lay your hands on the radio band at home.
It's that psychedelic time of the year. Do you know where you're...
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas, your one true voice in Kansas, this is the Radio Free Kansas.
Well, a little bit of the opening for the Damn Jackass radio show slipped through there. Sorry about that. We've got a good lineup today, Law and Disorder Radio. We got the latest headlines. I did get them for you from Democracy Now!, which is coming up next. And in the second hour, we'll have some time to talk, and I'm going to play about a scandal brewing on the Security Council at the United Nations recently in the last week. About the deceptions of the United States and England and perhaps other powers. I'm not sure who all is involved in it. Deceptions of the chemical warfare gases used in Syria. And the scandal within the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, and it's very interesting. And one of my favorite journalists from the Gray Zone covered it. I'm going to play the audio as much as I can of it. in the second hour. So I hope you enjoyed the, the weather here is wild. We're obviously in a state of transition. The winds are anywhere from 20 to 25 miles per hour out of the south, and we're very quickly going up to, I would say, 50, 60 degrees today, and they're projecting 74 degrees Fahrenheit tomorrow here in northeast Kansas. So there are gusts that are, I can tell the gusts are going to be up in the 30s and 40 mile per hour area. So here we go with the this morning's headlines for Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations has adopted a landmark resolution that seeks to hold countries accountable for failing to respond to the climate crisis while protecting more vulnerable nations. On Wednesday, the UN General Assembly voted on a measure calling on the International Court of Justice to establish obligations under international law for nations to protect their populations from the impacts of global heating. The resolution was introduced by the low-lying Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu, which the UN has described as the nation most vulnerable to natural disasters. Its adoption comes a month after Vanuatu was hit by two powerful tropical cyclones. This is Cynthia Huniohi of the Solomon Islands, one of 27 students from eight Pacific Island countries who launched the campaign for the resolution.
It's amazing to see and humbling to see how this wild idea that we had, you know, 4 years ago made its way from our classroom in the University of the South Pacific to the table or the floor of the United Nations General Assembly and to receive such a historic UN vote, you know, they vote by consensus. So that is, I still can't believe it happened.
The United States did not support the resolution. A senior Biden administration official told Reuters, quote, "We believe that diplomacy, not an international judicial process, is the most effective path forward," unquote. Here in the United States, the Biden administration opened bidding Wednesday on oil and gas leases covering more than 73 million acres of the central and western Gulf of Mexico, an area roughly the size of Italy. Fossil fuel companies secured access to 1.6 million of those acres. Environmental groups blasted the Interior Department's lease sale as unconscionable and another betrayal of President Biden's campaign pledge to ban all new oil drilling on federal land, they said. In France, the European Court of Human Rights heard arguments Wednesday in a landmark lawsuit brought by women retirees from Switzerland who are suing the Swiss government over its failure to tackle the climate crisis. Members of the group Senior Women for Climate Protection argue older people's rights are being violated since they're at the highest risk of the extreme heat that's becoming more frequent due to global heating. Helping to argue the case were members of the ENRI, the European Network of National Human Rights Institutions.
Few people have it in their power to change the course of history. You do. On behalf of all national human rights institutions in Europe, ENRI urges the court to use its power to protect vulnerable individuals against escalating and irreversible climate harm. The facts are simple. Greenhouse gas emissions cause heat extremes that kill.
Mexico has launched a homicide probe into this week's fire at an immigrant jail in Ciudad Juarez near the U.S. border, which killed 39 asylum seekers. This is Mexican Security Minister Rosa Isela Rodriguez.
Al momento se tienen identificados.
We have identified eight people allegedly responsible for the events, two federal agents, one state migration agent, and five members of the private security company are already testifying before the prosecutor's office. Part of the investigation is to confirm why civil protection protocols were not followed. It's clear that they were not respected. Also, we want to know why they did not save lives and were not able to open a gate.
The tragedy has brought renewed scrutiny to the border policies many have called inhumane enacted by the U.S. and the harsh conditions at Mexican migrant jails. The United States Senate has voted to repeal the authorizations for the 1991 Gulf War and the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Wednesday's vote was 66 to 30, with 18 Republicans voting in favor of repealing the AUMFs, or authorizations for the use of military force. This is New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez.
This vote shows that Congress is prepared to claw back our constitutional role in deciding how and when a nation goes to war, and also when it should end wars. It also protects against future administrations abusing authorizations that outlive their mandate but remain on the books.
Among Democrats who voted to repeal the Iraq War authorizations were Senators Chuck Schumer, Maria Cantwell, and Dianne Feinstein, who voted in favor of authorizing force in Iraq in 2002. President Joe Biden, who also voted in favor of the invasion as a senator, has promised to sign the repeal if it's approved by the House. Turkey's parliament is voting today on whether to ratify Finland's bid to join NATO. It's the last remaining barrier to Finland's accession to the military alliance. If the ratification is approved, as expected, NATO will add more than 800 miles to its border with Russia. This comes as 10 nations, led by Canada, are wrapping up nearly 2 weeks of NATO war games in Latvia, a former Soviet republic that joined NATO in 2004. In Russia, thousands of troops began war games in Siberia Wednesday to train on the use of Russia's Yars mobile intercontinental ballistic missile system. The nuclear drills came as the Biden administration said it had stopped sharing detailed data on its strategic nuclear forces with Russia after President Vladimir Putin suspended Russia's participation in the New START nuclear arms treaty. Meanwhile, Russia says it has detained U.S. Citizen and Wall Street Journal correspondent Evan Gershkovich, accusing him of spying. He was arrested in the city of Yekaterinburg in Russia's Ural Mountains. If convicted of espionage, Gershkovich faces up to 20 years in prison. West Virginia has banned gender-affirming health care for transgender minors, joining at least 10 other states that have enacted similar laws. The law makes an exception in cases where an adolescent is deemed to be at risk for self-harm or suicide, is diagnosed with severe gender dysphoria by two health care specialists, and has received parental consent. Meanwhile, in Kentucky, Republican lawmakers on Wednesday voted to override Democratic Governor Andy Beshear's veto of a sweeping anti-trans bill, which bans gender-affirming health care and forces people to use public restrooms that do not align with their gender. Protesters chanted from the House gallery during Wednesday's proceedings, leading to 19 arrests. In Tennessee, hundreds of people gathered at a candlelight vigil in Nashville Wednesday evening, mourning the three adults and 3 9-year-old students killed by a heavily armed shooter at the Covenant School on Monday morning. First Lady Jill Biden joined the ceremony. On Capitol Hill, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said Wednesday, Republicans want to see all the facts before proposing any new gun legislation in the wake of the school shooting. That prompted a heated confrontation between New York Democratic Congressmember Jamal Bowman and Kentucky Republican Congressmember Thomas Massey just off the House floor, where Bowman accused Republicans of refusing to save children's lives.
They cowered. Three 9-year-olds. Are they going to those funerals? No. They never go to the funerals. They never go to the scene of the mass shooting. And it's not just in schools. Black and brown communities every day.
Kentucky Republican Thomas Massey responded to Bowman, quote, saying there's never been a school shooting in a school that allows teachers to carry, unquote. In 2021, Massey tweeted a photo of himself and 6 family members holding assault-style rifles with the caption, Merry Christmas, P.S. Santa, please bring ammo. In Los Angeles, 7 California Highway Patrol officers and 1 nurse were charged Wednesday with involuntary manslaughter over the 2020 death of 38-year-old Edward Bronstein. Bronstein was detained during a traffic stop and violently pinned down at a highway patrol station in order to draw a blood sample, despite Bronstein saying multiple times he would give the sample voluntarily, screaming, "I can't breathe," 12 times. The Texas Observer announced it has reversed plans to shut down and will continue publishing after a staff-led crowdfunding campaign raised over $300,000. The Texas Observer, once edited by the legendary muckraking journalist Molly Ivins, is a bastion of progressive reporting in Texas and beyond. And in Australia, lawmakers advanced a move to hold a historic referendum that would recognize Indigenous people in the Australian Constitution and establish an Indigenous Voice to Parliament committee. This is Thomas Mayo, a member of the referendum working group.
It's not good enough that here in this country, the life expectancy of Indigenous peoples is almost 10 years less than other Australians. It's not good enough that proportionately we are the most incarcerated people on the planet. It's not good enough that our youth languish in detention in obscene numbers. They should be our hope for the future. It's time for us to have a voice.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Well, they cut it. Amy Goodman cut it off a little early there. That's democracynow.org, democracy.org. You can go there every morning and catch the latest. Here in Northeast Kansas, you can catch it on channel 19.2 over the air, free, at the local PBS affiliate at 7 a.m. And if you're out driving it to work, per se, 8 a.m. You can listen to it at 90.1 on KKFI FM radio. And now, Law and Disorder. And stay tuned in the second hour. I've got some more stuff for you.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the most pressing disaster on the horizon, the bank failures. And we're going to speak with Professor Richard Wolff, the economist.
One of the questions we'll ask him is how far this bank scandal may yet grow. We'll also talk to Steve Rohde, our go-to expert on the Supreme Court with respect to some very troubling cases before the Supreme Court and what adverse decisions on them might mean for America.
This is an activist, reactionary Supreme Court. No one follows it and understands what's going on more than Steve Rohde.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
On March 10th, the Silicon Valley Bank, the most important bank in Silicon Valley, failed. This bank held the money of some of the wealthiest people in the world, venture capitalists who invested in tech businesses. The government bailed it out, hoping to prevent a crisis from becoming a nationwide contagion like the one in 2008, when even larger banks failed. As a consequence, in 2008, 8.7 million people lost their jobs. Unemployment jumped to 10%. There was a one-third drop in the value of homes, and 10 million people lost their homes. The government did nothing to help them. After the Silicon Valley Bank crashed, the Signature Bank in New York crashed, followed by the Republic Bank and then Credit Suisse. We still may not be out of the woods. We speak today with economics professor Richard Wolff on why the economy was threatened with collapse and what must be done to protect us from the unstable banking system that we live under. Richard Wolff is Emerita Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts, where he taught for 35 years. And he's a visiting professor at the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York City. He's the founder of Democracy at Work and host of their national syndicated show, Economic Update. Professor Wolff has authored numerous books on capitalism and socialism, including most recently, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. He also has written Understanding Socialism and Understanding Marxism, which can be found at www.democracyatwork.info. Richard Wolf, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Rick, on March 10th of 2023, the Silicon Valley Bank, the most important bank in the Silicon Valley, with $209 billion in assets, failed. U.S. regulators intervened immediately to protect its depositors, thereby bailing out some of the wealthiest people in the world. So far, they've prevented the crash from becoming a nationwide banking contagion, like what happened in 2008. Tell us what happened in 2008.
Well, in 2008, we had a problem with a private banking system. And the way a private banking system works is that everybody in a private bank has to do one particular task, and that is to come up with a way to improving the quote-unquote bottom line. It is a profit-driven enterprise. Anything and everything anyone can think of to enhance the profit is what they're supposed to do. They get rewarded if they succeed. They get fired if they fail. And so the drive is on. To imagine that they would only come up with investments, for example, or strategies that are safe, that are not damaging to people, that don't go too far with risk, is to misunderstand what private enterprise means and how it drives the people caught up in it. Long story short, they pumped money into the hands of people for buying homes, mortgages, that those people's incomes could not sustain. So it was only a matter of time before those people could not come up with the monthly payment. Meantime, that they had erected an effective house of cards of instruments that are called derivatives that are based on those mortgages being paid off by the people who use them to buy a home. When those people couldn't do it, which anyone who knows about the business could have foretold you, well, then all the derivatives based on them were suddenly without value. Since many banks had invested in buying and selling the derivatives as well as the mortgages, the whole house of cards fell apart once it was clear that a significant number of Americans were not being paid enough money to sustain the mortgage. But the bottom line is that money is a crucial thing for a capitalist economy. We all depend on money. Therefore, it's a social phenomenon. To leave it in the hands of private enterprises whose business is to make money, profit, not to take care of the social need for money, is stupid. And what it's going to do is periodically you're going to have a clash between what's privately profitable and what the society needs. That's what happened in 2008, and everyone should remember it's the umpteenth financial breakdown that American capitalism has had, and here we are 11 or 12 years later, and we got another one.
Yes, Rick, that's what I was about to ask you about. The Silicon Valley Bank and at least three others for now have failed. I thought we had laws ever since the Great Depression of the 30s that protected us. Did the Fed raising interest rates have anything to do with what's going on today, or is it more than that?
It's a bit more than that. Let's deal with two things, the interest rates and the reforms that we've had. We have had, as I mentioned, many economic financial crashes. We used to call them in the 19th century bank panics, and that was a wonderful word, panic, because that's exactly what happens every time the monetary system crashes. I want to stress, it has happened 20, 30 times in American history. It is not new or unusual. After the worst of these crashes, we have reforms. We have political leaders then, as now, saying, oh, we're going to have to reform the bank laws or write a new one. Dodd-Frank, after the 2008 disaster, Glass-Steagall was the name of the big reform after the crash of the 1930s. Both of those reforms had to be fought for over the opposition of the banks. Even when they were passed by the Congress, the opposition continued and slowly but steadily weakened or evaded these reforms. That's the history of every reform. That's what the word reform means. It doesn't change the problem, and it leads the businesses affected to use their profits and use their wealth to undo the reform that stands in the way of maximizing their profit. So yes, there were reforms after the 2008 crash, but they were subsequently delayed, they were subsequently weakened, they were subsequently evaded, and that's what happened with the Silicon Valley Bank, number one. Number two, the Silicon Valley Bank was caught in an economic crisis that's really important for people to understand. On the one hand, they serve the most dynamic sector of the American economy, high tech in that valley from San Jose to San Francisco. Okay, they accepted deposits from all of the high tech companies that are in that area, particularly the newer startup kind of companies, and they had a special relationship with them. They got all these deposits, and then they do what every bank does. They take the deposits that individuals and companies put in the bank, and they lend them out. They get the deposits for relatively little, next to nothing, and they earn interest on whoever they lend those deposits to. Well, the most popular lender over recent, the most popular place to lend the money by the banks over recent years was the U.S. government. So they bought what are called treasury bonds. The problem is, if you raise interest rates, the value of a treasury bond goes down. So they were caught in the usual dilemma. They had taken the deposits, invested them in something, government bonds, that lost value. Once people figured this out, they realized that this bank didn't have enough in its investments to honor and return the money of the depositors. And that frightened the depositors. They pulled their money out. That forced the bank to sell the devalued bonds, and it couldn't manage that. And that started to frighten everybody, because people know enough to know that if this is happening in one big bank, then it is almost certainly happening to plenty of others. At that point, the government came in terrified that what had happened, that the behavior of the Silicon would in fact be contagious, as it has proven to be. One footnote that people should understand. Why is the problem arose is because the Federal Reserve raised interest rates. But why did the Federal Reserve do that? Because we have another problem called inflation in the United States. And the Federal Reserve, trying to solve one problem, created another one. When that kind of thing happens, as it is happening in our country, it's a sign that the system as a whole is busted. It's broken. Solving one problem worsens another. And there's no back and forth and no escape from this calamity unless you face that it's a systemic problem and not a problem of this or that bank.
So economics professor Richard Wolff, the billion-dollar question, will the contagion spread?
The honest answer to that is I don't know. The more honest answer is nobody else does either. You can be sure, and I know from personal contact, that the entire financial regulatory structure of this country, the U.S. Treasury, the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, the Comptroller of the Currency, every one of those offices is in a panic trying to figure out how bad is the contagion. That there is contagion, there's no question. I'll give you a couple of examples. Well, I'll just give you one in the interest of time. There's a very old established bank that serves mostly wealthy people based in San Francisco. It's called the First Republic Bank. A little over a year ago, the value of the share of that bank, if you bought it in the stock exchange, was about $200. Currently, the value of that same share is about $13. In other words, it has lost its entire value. Why? Even though it serves the richest people in the country, it was caught in the same problem. The value of its bonds had gone down with rising interest rates, began to be scared that their deposits would not be safe. There was then the run on the banks. So, yeah, there's been a contagion. There's not even clarity yet what other banks might be in that problem. And here's the worst of it. There are other problems people aren't even talking about yet, but that are well known to people in the business. I'm going to give you one example. Because of the pandemic and because of the changing American economy that nobody manages as a whole, we have a situation where many, many office buildings are full of empty offices. People who used to work in an office now work from home because of the pandemic, the crash, et cetera, et cetera. Many, many offices are empty. Many, many offices are not paying rent to the landlords of those offices. Those landlords borrowed the money to build the office towers. That means if their rentals aren't coming in, which they aren't, they will be unable to pay the banks back on the loans. Once the banks are forced, which they haven't been yet, to tell everybody in this country how many of their the loans they've made will never be paid back by empty offices, you're going to see a whole nother run on the banks. And in their weakened condition, nobody can tell you how and even whether these kinds of problems, and there are more of them, are going to be solved. It's another sign that your problem goes beyond the banks. It is a systemic problem. This system has too many accumulated problems. It cannot solve them all. And as it tries to, it worsens one even when it ameliorates another.
Well, Rick, the next question I want to ask you, I think, may get you into that even more. Obama was president back in 2009. At that time, the award-winning journalist Ron Suskind wrote about a meeting that Obama had in the Oval Office with the heads of the major banks. The bankers were scared. The American people were angry. Obama could have done, well, pretty much anything, or certainly many things, to the banks. But instead, he came in the room and he told the bankers that they should not worry, that he was on their side, that he was the only one, and I quote here, standing between them and the pitchforks, close quote. What understanding should we take away from learning about that incident? Do the financial giants have a stranglehold over our economy and our government? What does this tell us about the two-party system in this capitalist country?
Well, I'm afraid the simple and the brief answer is yes. No president that in recent memory would dare or did dare to do anything other than pander to those people. The amount of money that they dispose of, the connections these leading bankers have with the rest of leading industries in the country, their international connections, you'd have to have an extraordinary situation for any leading politician to go against them, and certainly not a president, not at a time of difficulty. He had to make sure that they did not betray him, and the way to do that would be to promise to take care of them. And indeed, the stopgap measures being used now are extraordinary in how they support the bankers. I mean, the government of the United States, let's be clear, Janet Yellen, the Secretary of the Treasury, and Mr. Powell at the Fed have told the American people that the government will stand behind all depositors in all banks. I mean, we can pretend we have a private banking system because that's what the private bankers want us to do. But what they've basically arranged is a costless government insurance of everything they do. They don't have to worry now. They can use their deposits for anything, however risky you can imagine. Why? Because if ever things go sour, if the risky investments turn bad on them, which is just what happened, well, then the government will come in and keep all their depositors happy, even though they can't, in fact, do it. What you've done here is basically arranged for the socialization of the costs of banking, while you keep the profits from it in the private hands of the bankers. You could not get a more accommodating policy from the Republican Party than has just been given by the Democratic Janet Yellen and the president who supervises what she does. So, the two political parties, if anything, should be understood to compete with one another to get the support, the approval, the donations of the leading banks in this country. And they do the same for the leading industries. The reason we don't have a better safely railroad system is because the railroad companies have the same kind of meetings with the president and issue the same demands and get the same support. We will hear about reforms. Meanwhile, the trains will get derailed, and we'll have all the revelations afterwards that the reforms were too little, too late, too weak, and all the rest of it. The American people have to decide whether they're going to stay with a system that works like this, has one disaster after another, then goes through these rituals of reform and then waits for the next disaster, even though nowadays they come sooner and with less time between than ever before.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my ex-law partner, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with economics professor Richard Wolff. In the group of bankers Jim just referred to in the Oval Office was Jamie Dimon. Jamie Dimon is the head of the largest bank in America, the Chase Manhattan Bank. His bank was one of the reasons for the 2008 crash. Nevertheless, the bank received $25 billion from the federal government to bail them out. The crash was caused largely by the careless and fraudulent lending practices it and others carried out. Dimon was never chastised, let alone indicted or sent to prison. That year he made $20 million. Last year he made $35 million. Here's my question. Dimon has stated that he opposes Medicare for all. He opposes paid sick leave or free higher education. He calls this aspect socialism and said that socialism would be, quote, a disaster for our country, end quote, and that he would result in corruption and authoritarianism. Rick Wolff, how do you respond to that allegation?
Well, the first thing I do is I laugh, and then I start thinking about it all, and then I stop laughing. What Mr. Dimon knows about socialism would, I won't be mean. He has no idea what he's talking about. Authoritarian, that would describe typically what a CEO in every corporation is, a man elected not by the workers over whom he rules, but by a tiny group of wealthy people that own big blocks of shares. There's nothing democratic about the J.P. Morgan Chase Bank. He's the leader. He has virtually absolute power. He can fire anyone, deprive them of a job, deprive them of their income. He wields vast amounts of money. This is a dictator. This is a king. This is a person who wouldn't understand democratic procedure because he has nothing whatever to do with it. Nothing in that bank is run democratically, and they don't even think about it. So who's he to give anybody else lessons about what alternative systems might achieve? It's kind of silly. He's, by the way, in charge of trying to save the First Republic Bank that I mentioned the other day. He was given that job by I don't know whom. It's this wonderful magic whereby one of the biggest bankers in the world with the history you described is suddenly in charge of one of the failing banks now, trying to save it or fix up some way to prevent it from going down the tubes as well. These kinds of people in our society do what they do, make the decisions, have this awful social consequences, and nothing happens to them. Their pay goes maybe from $30 million a year to $20 million, and then a year later back up to $30 million to make up for it all. He's a multimillionaire. He has been for a long time. He sits on top of the pyramid that runs the American system. He has absolutely no incentive to change it because for him, it's good news. When I say the system isn't working, I always add the phrase, for most people. Why? Because there are people who sit on top of our corporate structure for whom it's working very well indeed.
Yeah, and you know, Rick, I was just thinking, listening to you, it's so true, and we have these repetitive recessions, of course, 1990, 2001, 2008, 2020. Another one, you know, may be on the way. What's the reason for these recessions? Why do we have them, and what can be done about it? Should the banks, for example, be made, public utilities?
Well, let me answer the last one first. Yeah, I think banks should be public utilities because they basically already are. We like to make a joke, right, as Americans. Money makes the world go round. Okay, that's a recognition that the money system we have, the quantity of money, the terms on which you can borrow or lend money, these are absolutely crucial from the biggest to the smallest company, from Texas to Florida to California to Oregon and everywhere else. Money is key to the social survival of our nation. Why then do we not have a social program to control the money? Why are we leaving the management of our money in the hands of private enterprises who tell you that they're in it to make profit for themselves and their shareholders? It is irrational to think that you're going to get a good social outcome if you don't allow the society in some democratic way to control, to monitor, to supervise what's going on. Look, we have in every one of the 50 states a utility commission. We have in every one of the 50 states an insurance commission. Why? Because the insurance companies and the utilities have repeatedly abused their situation to overcharge people, to underserve them. And so a cry went up in American history at various points to get social supervision so that these private enterprises don't fatten themselves on profits at the expense of everybody else. Why in the world do we not do the same for the banking industry? I've asked the question all my life. I've never gotten a serious, plausible answer, because the truth of it is, they have been, the private banks, strong enough to prevent, to block all the efforts. There is one state in this country that has a publicly owned and operated supervised bank. It may surprise you. It's called the state of North Dakota. They have a public bank owned and operated by the state, not by any private people. If it makes a profit, which it is not determined or required to do, then guess what? That profit gets distributed back into the state and substitutes for taxes, so that the taxes of everybody else in North Dakota are reduced by the amount of any profit that the bank earns, because that goes into the general treasury. What an interesting idea. You know how long they've had that in North Dakota? Over a century. Republicans and Democrats and big private banks have tried to undo this publicly owned and operated bank. And the conservative workers and farmers of North Dakota have prevented that from happening. They've prevented the privatization of the bank because it has worked so well to help the people of North Dakota and the businesses, recirculating the money the taxes people pay as loans out to the businesses of that state. They love it. But that has to be kept secret, lest the American people in every one of the other 49 states or in the country as a whole might come to the same conclusions, having had bank and financial failures and panics of the sort we're literally living through now. You would think that a rational public response would be to say, we've had enough. Enough demonstrations that private banking is dangerous for the public welfare, and we need to move, as we did with utilities, as we did with insurance, to a completely different system in which the people as a whole, the workers in the bank, the customers of the bank, can together make sure that the bank serves their needs, because they're the majority, not the private profit needs of a very small minority.
Richard Wolff, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but before we have to let you go, can you tell our listeners how people can stay in touch with you, with Democracy at Work, your radio program, and your books?
Sure, I'd be glad to. The easiest, quickest way is to go to our website. It's all one word, democracyatwork, info, I-N-F-O. And there you can be directed to the media we produce, the weekly radio and television show we produce and disseminate called Economic Update, our books, and all the rest of the stuff we do. But the kinds of information I've tried to give you in answers to your question, that's what you'll get and much more on that website, and you can follow out all of its different parts.
Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Oh, yes, Rick. Thank you so very, very much.
My pleasure, and thank you for having a program that brings this kind of conversation to the American people. We need it now more than ever.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
As I said before, it's really groovy. I'd like to bore you for about 6 or 7 minutes to do a little thing. Yeah. Excuse me for a minute. Just let me play my guitar, all right? Right now, with this thing by Bob Dylan. That's his grandma over there. That's a little thing called Like a Rolling Stone.
The ever more conservative and activist Supreme Court has already heard arguments this term in a number of cases of vital importance. The cases involve the legality of President Biden's student debt relief plan, the fate of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and other independent agencies, and the liability of social media sites, where it is claimed that Google's algorithm sent people to a hateful site that the plaintiff in the case claimed led to an Islamic State attack that killed their child. Also of concern is the Supreme Court's refusal to take an appeal from a lower court opinion upholding the state of Kansas law, forbidding the state from doing business with any company that refuses to certify it does not support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions or BDS movement against Israel. And there is the Helaman-Hansen case that addresses the question of whether the First Amendment permits criminal punishment of speech that merely encourages a non-citizen to remain in the United States without any requirement of intent to further illegal conduct, and when remaining in the United States unlawfully is itself not a crime. Happily, our guest today is once again our go-to person when we want to understand the impact of the Supreme Court on our lives. I'm speaking, of course, of Stephen Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a noted constitutional scholar and activist. He is the past chair of the American Civil Liberties Union Foundation of Southern California, the founder and current chair of the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. He is the author of American Words of Freedom and of the book Freedom of Assembly. Steve Rohde is a regular contributor to Truthdig as well as to the Los Angeles Review of Books, and he is a leader in the national campaign to free the imprisoned investigative journalist Julian Assange. Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Michael and Jim. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Steve, let's get started, with the cases of Gonzalez v. Google and Twitter v. Tamina. As the Gonzalez case points out, where it's claimed that Google's algorithm sent people to a hateful site that the plaintiffs in the case claim led, in turn, to an Islamic State attack that killed their child. And similar situation with the Twitter case. What can you tell us about the facts and the law in these cases, Steve? And did the oral argument shed any good light on how the court may ultimately decide? And why are these cases so important?
Well, these are very important cases. You know, I'm suspicious of this conservative Supreme Court. So far, none of these cases may reach the level of overruling Roe v. Wade from last year, but they are key cases, and it's always a question of what dangerous mischief the justices can get into when they address any one of these important topics. This involves social media in two cases in very appealing, very dramatic circumstances, but they ask the question of to what extent will the government control the content of social media. People are upset with content on social media unless and until it comes to regulating their speech on social media. Now, in all of this, listeners have to understand Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. This is a 27-year-old law that Congress passed as part of the Communications Decency Act. The internet was young and growing, and Congress did not want internet sites to be penalized for the content of the users on those sites. They wanted to compare them to, like, the telephone company, which cannot be responsible for everything folks say over the telephone. But of course, social media has grown and expanded, and now the serious question is the liability of a site such as YouTube, in this case of Gonzalez. Now, here we had Ms. Gonzalez, an American student, killed in a 2015 ISIS attack. Because of that algorithm that YouTube uses, it can automatically, quote, recommend different sites to different people depending on their prior viewing habits. And just for that recommendation, this victim and the family sued YouTube. Now, the oral argument was quite amazing because the one area where there may be common ground on the Supreme Court is in the First Amendment area. Conservatives and liberals can sometimes agree that we still need a robust, wide-open freedom of speech. And how much can you hold a social media site, or in this case YouTube, for what others may say on that site? It's going to test the question, and many of the justices asked, what about lawsuits involving alleged antitrust violations or discrimination or defamation or infliction of emotional distress because of the third-party content that people are posting? One of the justices asked, well, what if you like, you just hit the like button or you retweet or you say, check this out? Can someone be held civilly liable for damages as a result of that? The second case is interesting because it brings up a separate statute, and this also tugs at different interests. There is an anti-terrorism statute which says that any person who aids and abets by knowingly providing substantial assistance or who conspires with the person who committed such an act of international terrorism. And here again on Twitter, because there were some unrelated tweets involving ISIS, the family of someone who was attacked in Istanbul at a terrorist attack sued Twitter, alleging that Twitter was responsible or can be held for damages for the killing of this individual. The justices from both sides of the spectrum threw out questions. Well, what if someone simply advertises for a cell phone and terrorists buy that cell phone? And what are the limits to holding media responsible? So the truth is, I have no tea leaves on this, except that virtually all of the justices are skeptical, and they may send it back to Congress to take a second look at that Section 230 from 27 years ago.
It reminds me of the old adage that hard cases make bad law. But I wanted to ask you about the Supreme Court, who heard an oral argument in two related cases, both of which challenge the legality of President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan, a plan that was struck down by a lower appellate court some months ago. What is at stake? Is 40 million people hoping to receive up to $20,000 apiece on their individual federal loan debt cancellation? What are the legal issues in this case, and what, if anything, did we learn as a result of the oral arguments before the court on these cases?
This is a case of immense impact to the pocketbooks and livelihoods of millions of students and families, as you mentioned, because Congress wasn't acting on these student loans. Actually, two presidents, President Trump and now President Biden, both invoked the HEROES Act, Higher Education Relief Opportunities for Students, which was passed in the wake of 9/11. The Congressional Act does say that the education secretary may waive or modify federal student loan financial assistance programs as the secretary deems necessary in connection with a war or other military operation or national emergency. Donald Trump paused student loans after declaring COVID a national emergency, and Biden then issued his lifting or relief from those student loans, even though COVID officially will supposedly end in May. The argument is that the economic impact of COVID lives on and justifies the suspension of these and cancellation of these student loans. As I think you mentioned, these cases came in two different courts. The states of Arkansas, Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska sued to obtain a temporary restraining order. And in a separate case, two individuals who only got $10,000 of relief wanted $20,000 of relief. Well, I think your listeners have learned that before a case can be heard on the merits, it always involves a question of standing. Does the petitioner have standing? And all of the justices expressed doubt about the flimsy standing that the six states have on the question of how is a state harmed by the lifting of student loans. So the three liberals and Amy Coney Barrett took this case, believing there's a serious standing issue. If there's no standing, then the court cannot strike down Biden's loan forgiveness. There's also another important doctrine here, and this is the one I worry about in the hands of the conservative court. It's something called the major question doctrine that Congress, under this judicial-created exception, must speak clearly on major policy questions to allow federal agencies to act. Now, this can be used to impair federal agencies and impair the executive branch. Justice Kavanaugh said some of the biggest mistakes have been made by deferring to the executive. We might agree with that as far as war making is concerned. Roberts asked, why should college be different than a loan for someone who has a lawn care business or someone who paid off their loans? Why should others get relief? So I think this will be a serious question. I'm going to make a guess here. The court will go off on the standing ground, which means this could be a victory for Biden's suspension and for those $4 billion of student loans.
Well then, Steve, let's consider the case of Consumer Financial Protection Bureau versus Community Financial Services Associates of America. And the issue in that case as to whether the way in which Congress chose to fund that agency violated the Appropriations Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Now, according to Adam Liptak, several weeks ago now, the New York Times said, and I quote, "A ruling against the Bureau, created as part of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, after the financial crisis, could cast doubt on every regulation and enforcement action it took in the dozens of years of its existence, close quote. So, Steve Rohde, this sounds ominous. Tell us the facts in this case, the arguments on both sides, if you will, and what a ruling against the agency in this case might mean for our country overall.
Well, this is very important also because the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, is a very important agency. It was promoted by Elizabeth Warren. It came in response to the 2008 financial crisis. Meanwhile, however, the conservative Supreme Court has been reining in the authority of federal agencies. Just last year, they limited the EPA. This is part of that conservative agenda to strangle and cut back on federal agencies attempting to address national problems. In this case, the Fifth Circuit found that the funding structure, which is not unique but original, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau draws its money from the U.S. Federal Reserve earnings, not from a budget passed by Congress. That's the design that Congress created. And the Fifth Circuit said that funding structure was improper, and three Trump judges struck it down. Now, again, it takes four votes to review, and it looks like the three liberals and one conservative, who isn't identified in the record, agreed to take this case. A very important case about the future of the consumer watchdog agency, and this case won't be argued until the October term.
And we're speaking with attorney Steve Rohde. Steve, a very important case that the court did not agree to consider is the Federal Appeals Court ruling that upheld the Kansas law prohibiting the state from doing business with any company that has refused to certify it does not support the anti-Israeli boycott, divestment, sanction movement. Why is this so important?
You know, sometimes it's important what this conservative Supreme Court does, and sometimes it's important what it does not do. It did not take this case. In late February, the court had a chance to defend the First Amendment and clear up conflicting opinions in lower courts. A dozen states have enacted anti-BDS laws in a variety of ways to punish individuals or organizations who take political positions in support of boycott, divestment, and the BDS movement. Now, this is an unusual case because the Arkansas Times, a newspaper in Little Rock, and the ACLU sued alleging that a public university refused to enter into an advertising contract with that newspaper unless the newspaper signed a pledge refusing to boycott Israel. They wouldn't agree not to boycott Israel. This public university wouldn't buy ads in the Arkansas Times. And if the contractors refused, it would reduce their income by 20%. This is one of a variety of laws meant to punish any support for the BDS movement. Three judges blocked the law, but the full Eighth Circuit reinstated the law. So the status quo was upholding that anti-BDS law in Arkansas, and instead, no more than three Supreme Court justices, the liberals, they could not get a fourth vote to take that up. This is a problem, because in 1982, in the civil rights context, in NAACP versus Claiborne in Mississippi, the Supreme Court clearly said that it's a First Amendment right to engage in economic boycott. We know how powerful they have been, including the boycott against apartheid in South Africa. So these laws are a direct conflict with established Supreme Court precedent, and yet the conservatives would not take up that case. The worry is it's a model to penalize boycotts of fossil fuel firms or other industries. So not taking that case is a sinister development in this court.
So these pro-Zionists are really undercutting our democratic rights.
I wonder, Steve, also, if we can take up another First Amendment case, I think, of considerable importance. I'm thinking of the Helaman-Hansen case. Again, a First Amendment case, as I say, concerning what constitutes criminal speech. Talk to us about this case, the facts, and why it's important.
This was a case in which a statute that makes it a felony to encourage or induce an alien to come into, enter, or reside in the United States knowing or in reckless disregard of such coming to, entry, or residence is or will be in violation of the law. U.S. versus Helaman-Hansen, it's a draconian anti-immigration statute that is on the book. In this case, Mr. Hansen engaged in only dealing with people, undocumented persons already in the United States, and he wanted to provide support and help for them, and instead he was charged and convicted for, quote, encouraging of remaining in the United States. The ACLU and others are counsel in this case, along with the federal public defender. What they point out, that encouragement prohibitions violate the First Amendment because it would criminalize a wide swath of protected speech. In plain terms, it could make it a crime for a grandmother to say she doesn't want her undocumented child to leave her, or a doctor to advise her patient with an expiring student visa that she needs medical treatment provided only in the United States, or a lawyer to counsel an out-of-status non-citizen that she has the ability to become a lawful resident if she does not leave the country. This is the kind of statute that I worry in the hands of this conservative court could be used to punish speech, and particularly punish speech that embraces and supports immigration. This will be argued in the United States Supreme Court the day we're broadcasting this show, and I urge everybody to watch the news coverage of this important case.
Steve Rohde, unfortunately, we're coming to an end to our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you about your last thoughts, and how can our listeners follow your work and your writings? We're very grateful to be able to speak with you about this disastrous reactionary activist Supreme Court. Please, your last thoughts, and how can people follow your work?
Well, you're very kind. I enjoy these programs, and I'm so grateful to both of you that you broadcast valuable time on these issues. I just want to tell people that there are 30 remaining cases by this Supreme Court to be decided by June or July on abortion, guns, religion, climate change. This court can still engage in what I call dangerous mischief, so it's very important that everybody track these cases and realize that the Supreme Court is a political body. Supreme Court justices are nominated by presidents and approved by the Senate, and we should never lose sight of that.
Steve, how can people follow your work?
Well, I am available. I'm a contributing writer at the LA Review of Books, at Truthdig. Those sites maintain my columns and articles. A simple Google search will find my other writings. I'm not only supportive of the First Amendment, but I exercise my free speech and free press rights by sharing my thoughts as widely as I can.
Amen to that, Steve. Thank you very much. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Steve. Really, again, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Jim, as you know, because you've seen the movie, there's a wonderful movie called Ithaca about the Julian Assange situation. The founder of our Law and Disorder radio show was Julian Assange's first lawyer in America. Jim and I and our past guest, Steve Rohde, have all been very active in supporting Julian Assange. It's a question of free journalism. And if he is put over from England to the United States and tried and convicted and put in prison, they want to put him away for 175 years, it's the end of free journalism. The most important case we've going on in that area. Go see the movie, Ithaca. Go to lawanddisorder.org, and you can find out when it's playing in your area.
We're proud to put that on our website, folks, because it is vitally important. These kinds of radio programs that you like to listen to, the kind of really investigative journalism that you've come to count on if we're going to really understand the truth of what is going on in this country, depends on the work of people like Julian Assange. If he can be stopped, anyone could be stopped. And so we urge you to go to our website, find out when the movie's going to be playing in your area, see it, and it'll tell you how to get involved in supporting his right to be free.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
He's one of the he and Max Blumenthal and Anna Kasparian, I think that's her name. I'm not sure. Parenthal, I think is how you pronounce her name. They and others contribute to the Gray Zone, a website. Now, really, you know, don't just check them out on YouTube. Go to their website, the Gray Zone, and check out their journalism. It's excellent stuff. Excellent. Absolutely excellent. That's why I'm so happy to play their stuff. Now, this is Aaron Maté appearing before the United Nations Security Council, and he explains it all pretty well. It's about, well, he'll tell you. Just listen in. It's about chemical weapons and who's really using them.
Welcome to Pushback. I'm Aaron Maté. Recently, I had the chance to speak before members of the UN Security Council about the OPCW's Duma cover-up scandal. This is the story I've covered extensively at the Gray Zone about how the OPCW put out a report that baselessly implicated the Syrian government in an alleged chemical attack in Douma in April 2018 after censoring its own findings that showed actually there was no evidence of a chemical attack in Douma, and also showed evidence pointing to this incident being staged by insurgents on the ground. So I went before the UN for the third time. I was invited by Russia, which organized this meeting, and I spoke extensively about the cover-up and the OPCW's latest attempts to whitewash it. In this segment, I'm going to talk about a very significant development that happened at that meeting, which was that Brazil, the largest country in South America and one of the largest countries in the world, for the first time came out in support of accountability for the Douma cover-up and came out in support of listening to those dissenting inspectors on the Douma team who were silenced. So this was a very significant development that we're going to talk about today. Before we get to that, though, let me just show you a couple of clips of what I said. If you want to see my full remarks, I'll link to them in the show notes of this episode. But just here's a brief clip of the message I brought to the UN Security Council.
This is central to the issue of resolving of what happened in Douma, because we are now nearly 5 years later since that horrific incident, those horrific images of all those dead bodies. And the international watchdog that investigated this incident has suppressed its own findings into that incident, leaving those deaths unresolved. And so long as the OPCW continues to suppress the science, the Douma victims and their families will remain without justice.
So after I spoke, a number of other states gave remarks, including the U.S., U.K., and France. And these are the states that bombed Syria back in April 2018, based on the allegation that Syria was guilty of a chemical attack. And these are the same states that have helped lead the way in stonewalling any kind of accountability for the OPCW cover-up that has emerged since. In their remarks, none of them challenged my fundamental assertion that the OPCW's own findings were suppressed. And in my closing remarks, I pointed that out.
I want to note that in the responses from states, including the U.S. and U.K., that no one disputed the central claim of my remarks today, which was that the findings of the Douma probe were suppressed, censored. Now, I'm not here to pass any moral judgments, but I just want to note the fact that we have member states who do not contest the documented fact that the Douma findings were suppressed, but yet they oppose any action to address this suppression. And on that note, I'll also point out that I asked a question of these delegations, the U.S., U.K., and France. I mistakenly asked Germany, but they're not here, whether or not they will support the call of distinguished diplomats like the first director general of the OPCW, Jose Bustani, and former senior UN official, Hans von Sponeck, to simply have the OPCW meet with all of the original members of the Douma team and let them, not just the two dissenting inspectors, but all the original members of the Douma team, let them discuss their concerns and let them put forth the evidence that was suppressed. I never got an answer back to that question, which I've now asked several times.
And if you want to see my full remarks about the OPCW's Douma cover-up scandal, I will link to that in the episode notes for this show. So turning now to Brazil. And again, in a very significant development, Brazil came out in support of accountability for this cover-up. And the representative from Brazil began by pointing out that there were problems with how the OPCW has handled its investigations in Syria.
Let me start by thanking the Russian delegation for organizing this area formula. And I also want to thank the briefers for the wealth of information that they provided in this session. Mr. President, Brazil is committed to multilateralism and to the constant improvement of disarmament and non-proliferation regimes. We view an effective and impartial OPCW as a cornerstone of the international disarmament and non-proliferation architecture. despite being a golden standard among all disarmament regimes, the CWC has been repeatedly violated with numerous incidents of use of toxic chemicals as weapons. Instead of true accountability for such transgressions, the regime is being seriously affected in a series of accusations and counter-accusations. The establishment of ad hoc mechanisms, such as the IIT, have been a poor response to these challenges, having contributed to the demise of the culture of consensus in the organization.
So that was a representative of Brazil at the UN Security Council, pointing out that there are some serious flaws in how the OPCW has handled its Syria probes. And I can tell you, being in that room, as the representative was speaking, everybody was listening, because this is the first time that Brazil has come out so publicly in criticizing the OPCW's handling of the Syria file. And those who were especially listening were the representatives from the US and UK, who I think were not happy to be hearing Brazil come out in support of accountability for the OPCW's Syria cover-up scandal. And one of the reasons Brazil came out in support of accountability is because a veteran Brazilian diplomat is at the forefront of the fight for that accountability. His name is José Bustani. He is the founding director general of the OPCW. If you watch Pushback, you might remember him because I interviewed him a few years ago about this story and about his own experience at the OPCW, because he was the person who was ousted at the behest of the Bush administration 20 years ago when he was standing up to their plans to invade Iraq. He was trying to bring Iraq into the Chemical Weapons Convention. And because that effort by him interfered with the Bush administration's plans to invade Iraq, John Bolton personally flew over to The Hague, came into Bustani's office and threatened him. And when Bustani refused to resign, John Bolton engineered his ouster from the OPCW. And so now, 2 decades later, José Bustani has come out against another U.S.-backed pro-war deception, which is the Syria OPCW cover-up. Because José Bustani is so experienced, and these two veteran inspectors who challenged the cover-up of the Duma probe are so experienced, that they worked together back when José Bustani was the head of the organization. So José Bustani has come out in support of the dissenting inspectors on the Duma team. And in September 2020, he tried to speak at the United Nations in defense of the dissenting inspectors in the Duma probe and in support of accountability for the cover-up. He was blocked by the U.S. and their allies. And in my remarks, I pointed this out. Well, in his remarks, after I spoke, the representative from Brazil also invoked the experience of José Bustani.
Before I finish, I would like to touch on 4 points. First, and I also directly speak to Mr. Mate. First, it's difficult to believe the countries that you quote that have silenced Ambassador Bustani, denying him an opportunity to speak before the Security Council. Unfortunately, we know for a fact that your information is correct. Ambassador Bustani, luckily, was given a chance to talk, not in the Security Council, but through a documentary, Symphony of One Man, who is not easy to find, but is in Vimeo. For those who want, I can give the link to access the documentary and see for themselves that he has at least an interesting story to tell.
So that was the representative from Brazil talking about the experience of veteran Brazilian diplomat José Bustani, who was ousted by the U.S. As the first head of the OPCW after he stood up to their plans to invade Iraq. And that documentary he mentioned about José Bustani recently came out, and it tells his story, which is an amazing one. And it includes parts about José Bustani being blocked from testifying at the U.N. in defense of the dissenting OPCW inspectors who challenged the cover-up of their Duma probe. Then the Brazilian representative went on, and he specifically addressed me, and he asked me what I think are some very important questions.
Third, what you say, and what you said during your statement, unfortunately, damages the reputation of an organization. But you are clear, you are logical, and you come here with data. So, given the seriousness of what you said, I must ask you for reassurance that the data, the information, and the logical links that you present were thought over.
So that is the representative from Brazil at the UN Security Council. He went on to ask me another question, which has to do with what could be done to address the OPCW's Duma cover-up scandal.
My fourth and last point is that a point that you touched, but I would like to highlight. Do you think that it's possible for the OPCW to revisit the Duma investigation? In the affirmative, do you have suggestions as to how that revisitation could be done? And I thank you very much.
So as I mentioned, the representatives of the U.S. and U.K. were visibly not very pleased with what this Brazilian diplomat was saying. So when the UK delegation got the chance to speak, the UK representative specifically called out his colleague from Brazil.
ECWIIT has subsequently found the Syrian regime responsible for 5 chemical weapons attacks. And I would encourage all colleagues, my Brazilian colleague in particular, to read in detail the latest IIT report on the attack in Duma.
So that was the representative from the UK. His name is Thomas Phipps, and him and I actually also had an exchange, which I will cover in a different segment because he also was not happy with my remarks. Here he is urging his Brazilian colleague to read the IIT report, which is a report recently put out by the OPCW about Duma. Well, the Brazilian representative had a response to that.
Mr. Chair, the intervention by our colleague from the United Kingdom did not surprise you. It did surprise me. We had said that would evaluate the IIT report, and we did so. And the conclusion that we arrived at is that the IIT, and I repeat that, have been a poor response to the challenges that it was faced and contributed to the demise of the culture of consensus in the organization. So I would like to make that clear. That request for us to look into the truth and dig it out. I am an eternal optimist, and I must say that I am almost listening to the UK saying that should Ambassador Bustani be invited again to the Security Council, they would agree with him to participate, and I thank you.
So that is the Brazilian delegate's response, obviously not taking kindly to the UK delegate's remarks and asking him a question in response, asking him if he will support what the UK opposed before, which is allowing the veteran Brazilian diplomat, the first director general of the OPCW, Jose Bustani, the chance to speak before the UN Security Council. And because that UK delegate had left the room, but after he spoke, his name was Thomas Phipps, he never gave an answer. So, but hopefully the Brazilian delegation will receive an answer to that very important question. Will the UK and its allies finally allow the OPCW's first director general, Jose Bustani, the chance to speak before them about this very important issue? Well, at the end of the session was my turn to speak and to respond to the questions that I got from a delegate from Brazil. So Here was my response. He asked me about whether or not the information I presented was reliable, and I pointed out that it was based entirely on OPCW documents, especially leaked OPCW documents. And he also asked me about what solutions could be put forward to address the OPCW scandal, and I had some ideas to share there as well.
So turning to the representative's questions from Brazil, I thank you for these questions. He asked me whether we can be sure of the data that I presented. All of the data I presented comes from the OPCW itself. Nothing I said in my presentation comes from open sources. I could have mentioned open sources, such as a journalist from the BBC, which is a state-funded outlet of the UK, who said that he can prove unequivocally that the hospital scene in Douma was staged. I didn't mention that because I want to focus my presentation on the OPCW's findings itself, because that is really the heart of this matter, and that's what this council and that's what the OPCW can address. All of the data I presented today comes from documents from the OPCW, and again, no one challenges the authenticity of those documents, and no one, as the experience today illustrates, can refute the claims that were made by the original team, which were then suppressed in an act of deception. So yes, the data can be trusted because it comes from the OPCW itself. Now, there was another question from the representative of Brazil about whether I'm questioning the integrity of the OPCW. I am not. As we all know, the OPCW is an invaluable organization who play a critical role in the world and have achieved great success, including in Syria, in bringing Syria into the Chemical Weapons Convention and destroying Syria's chemical weapons stockpile. That was a major international achievement that unfortunately this controversy is distracting from. And this controversy only pertains to one small element of the OPCW. It does not taint the entire organization. And just to underscore that, back before this became public, leaked documents show that other OPCW officials, senior officials, praised the efforts of the key dissenting inspector, known as Inspector B, his name is Dr. Brendan Whelan, when he was trying to address this issue internally. So let me quote one senior OPCW official. This was back after Brendan Whelan complained about the doctoring of the original report that he was the chief author of. A senior OPCW executive wrote to Dr. Brendan Whelan this, quote, through your action, you could actually be making the first step toward having a more professional, transparent, and sound fact-finding mission. And that was a recognition simply that trying to stand up for the OPCW's own findings and trying to defend the science that was carried out, that helps solidify and strengthen the OPCW. Ignoring this suppression undermines the OPCW. Now, this senior official was not the only person from the OPCW to praise Dr. Whelan's efforts. In August 2018, just as Dr. Whelan was leaving the OPCW at the end of a very long tenure, another official wrote to him to praise him for his work, including in protesting the suppression of the OPCW findings in Douma. This is what the senior official wrote to Dr. Whelan. I can say without being unfair to others that you have been the professional in the technical secretariat that has contributed the most to the knowledge and understanding of chemical weapons chemistry applied to inspections. You produced a lot of knowledge and unselfishly shared every bit of what you know with others enthusiastically. I thank you very much for this. And then this second senior official specifically paid tribute to Dr. Whelan's actions to raise concerns about the Douma probe. This official wrote this, I want to commend you as well for your character and strong values, which have stood firm at times when it would have been easier to simply let it go without fighting for what you believed was right. Thank you for everything. It will be difficult to replace you now that your tenure is about to end. Well, now we have, nearly 5 years later, certain member states do not want to hear from this veteran inspector who was praised by his own colleagues for trying to defend the integrity of his own organization. Now, the representative from Brazil, and then I'll wrap, asked me what can be done to address the Douma controversy. There are a number of steps, all of them fully following the protocols of the OPCW. The first step is simply have the OPCW Director General invite all the inspectors to come meet and share their concerns. This was proposed by Dr. Whelan back in a letter written to the Director General back in April 2019, which I published, which was leaked to me. I published that letter at the Gray Zone. I'll be happy to provide you with a copy. But let me quote from it briefly. Dr. Whelan wrote to the Director General Arias. He said, should the entire fact-finding mission team be given an audience with senior management and provided there are clear and unequivocal guarantees that team members are permitted to speak freely and without fear of repercussions, a clear picture of the conduct of the investigation into the Duma incident will, I believe, emerge, which is a proposal I will put to you again today. A second step will be to simply follow, as I mentioned earlier, the verification annex of the Chemical Weapons Convention, paragraph 62, which says differing observations made by inspectors may be attached to a report. So we obviously know that some inspectors have differing observations. Let them write up those observations and attach them to the Duma reports that were put out by the OPCW. A third step was proposed by a group called the Berlin Group 21, and that was spearheaded by the former OPCW Director General, Jose Bustani, as well as Hans von Sponeck, a former UN Assistant Director General. And they proposed to the Director General of the OPCW, Arias, that he allow the OPCW's own scientific advisory board, which is made up of a number of independent scientific and technical experts, for them to come in and weigh this issue about Duma. And quoting them, quoting Hans von Sponeck and Mr. Bustani and their colleagues, the scientific advisory board possesses the necessary scientific and technical expertise. We believe that leaving the scientific debate to the scientists who best understand the issues at hand would provide a more objective and rational approach to begin resolving this unfortunate and highly damaging controversy. And there's nothing in the OPCW rules that prevent that. In fact, the terms of reference for the scientific advisory board of the OPCW state that in consultation with members of the board, the Director General may establish temporary working groups of scientific experts to provide recommendations within a specific time frame on specific issues in accordance with Article 8, Paragraph 45 of the Convention. Well, what issue is more important than this controversy surrounding the Duma investigation? And finally, in response to questions that he addressed this issue, the Director General, Arias, Fernando Arias, has said that it's not in his authority anymore to revisit old reports, that this is a done deal. But that is simply contradicted by the record of the OPCW. The OPCW in Syria, in fact-finding missions in Syria, has gone back and revised prior reports. So, for example, after publishing a final report on alleged chemical attacks by insurgents in Syria in December 2015, Syrian authorities invited the OPCW to return to collect further evidence that they claimed the report was lacking. The OPCW fact-finding mission team paid a second visit to Syria 1 month later and published an addendum to the final report. So there's a practice here of revisiting probes. There's nothing in the rules to prevent that. The OPCW didn't need even the Executive Council to approve that. They just did it because the rules allowed them to do that. And remarkably, in the case of Duma, no one is asking the OPCW to go back to Syria. The simple request is meet with the original team that went to Syria for this mission and let them air their concerns. That is the request. That is the core request being put to the OPCW today. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
So that was my response to the questions put to me by the Brazilian representative at the UN Security Council. A huge development that Brazil is not only posing these questions, but coming out in support of accountability for the OPCW's Syria cover-up scandal. Brazil, one of the largest countries in the world, the largest country in South America, and a major shift under President Lula, who recently took office, to come out and oppose the U.S. position here, or at least defy the U.S. position here, and come out in support of accountability for the OPCW's Syria cover-up scandal. I think it's very, very important. Also significant was that China affirmed support for accountability and also said that the dissenting inspectors on the OPCW's Duma team have the right to be heard.
With regard to the investigation and the handling of cases alleged use of chemical weapons, including the Duma incident in 2018, it is important to comply with the convention and the verification annex to ensure compliance procedure and reliable evidence for credible conclusions. As for the expert opinions from different perspectives, their right to be heard should be respected. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So a very momentous hearing at the UN Security Council, and one that I think has shown a very significant political shift with Brazil joining the calls for accountability over the scandal at the OBCW over its Duma investigation. And to learn more about this, I have new articles up at the Gray Zone about the OBCW scandal, which I will link to in the notes for this episode, and we'll have more coverage coming soon here on Pushback. That's it for now. Stay tuned for more coverage here on the Gray Zone. Welcome to Pushback. I'm Aaron Maté. As I've been covering, I recently spoke at a meeting of UN Security Council members about the OPCW's cover-up scandal in Syria, the censorship of findings in its probe of an alleged chemical attack in Douma that undermined allegations that the Syrian government was guilty. And this has been a cover-up going on for many years now, which I've covered extensively at the Gray Zone. And in this segment, I want to talk about an aspect of this meeting that occurred between me and the British representative. The UK has been very central to the OPCW cover-up. The UK joined the US and France in bombing Syria based on the allegations. And then when OPCW leaks emerged showing that the OPCW had suppressed findings that undermined the case that Syria was guilty of a chemical attack in Douma, and these findings also pointed to this incident being staged by insurgents backed by the US and UK. The UK was among the states that have tried very hard to suppress any accountability for this cover-up. So that was on display at the UN when I came to speak. Before I get to the UK representative's remarks, here is just a brief clip of what I said at the UN.
This is now the third time that I've had the opportunity to address members of the Security Council about the controversy surrounding the OPCW's investigation of the alleged chemical attack in Douma. And if I can share one opinion, while I really appreciate this opportunity, I have to say that I find it unfortunate that nearly 5 years after that alleged incident in Douma, this controversy around the OPCW investigation is still being debated in public rather than being addressed by the OPCW. Because fundamentally, this is a controversy that is internal to the OPCW. And at the heart of it are at least two veteran inspectors from the OPCW with nearly 30 years of combined experience who worked on the Douma investigation, who deployed to Syria for the Douma investigation. And what they say is very simple. They have accused senior officials at the OPCW of suppressing findings from their probe and putting out unsupported conclusions that baselessly implicate the Syrian government in a chemical attack. And they are not demanding that their own opinions be affirmed as the ultimate truth. They just want the right to be heard. And rather than hearing these inspectors, allowing them to come in and voice their concerns, allowing the OPCW to weigh the findings that were suppressed, the OPCW has refused to meet with them, and he's even denigrated them in public.
So that is from my opening remarks at the United Nations. For my full comments, you can go to thegrayzone.com, and I'll link to my comments also in the notes for this episode. Well, turning now to the British government's response. So after I spoke, many countries had the chance to share their comments on the OPCW and Syria. And one of them was the representative from the UK. His name is Thomas Phipps. He's a British diplomat. I've sparred with him many times on Twitter. And here we were face to face. And he did not like what I had to say. But first, this is what he said overall about the meeting, which was organized by Russia, and the issue of Syrian chemical weapons in general.
Russia's systematic efforts to undermine the integrity of the OPCW over the last decade are almost as egregious as Russia's repeated use of chemical weapons. No one should be fooled by today's charade. Your choice of briefers, your denial of the Syrian regime's repeated chemical weapons use, your attacks on the OPCW's work, your recent refusal to engage in council members on council meetings on Syria chemical weapons all lay bare your cynicism in organizing an event that purports to address the APCW's diminishing authority. The vast majority of the international community understands that it is you that has worked to undermine the APCW. Colleagues, the Chemical Weapons Convention and the work of the APCW is too important for us to allow the Russian Federation to succeed. In 1988, 8 years after diplomatic negotiations on the convention began, Saddam Hussein's Iraqi army conducted a chemical weapons attack on the village of Halabja, which killed between 3,000 and 5,000 people. The horror and the deaths of these thousands of civilians brought increased urgency to efforts to secure a commitment by states to never, under any circumstances, develop, produce, acquire, stockpile, transfer, or use chemical weapons. 20 years after the convention was opened for signature in Paris, the Assad regime released the nerve agent sarin in the Ghouta district of Damascus, killing more than 1,400 people, many of them children. Despite the adoption by consensus of Resolution 2118 in 2013, the Syrian regime did not destroy all of its chemical weapon stocks, and the Council continues to discuss to this day the gaps and inconsistencies in Syria's initial declaration. We know that the Assad regime went on to use chemical weapons on numerous occasions, including in Douma in 2018.
So that is British diplomat Thomas Phipps. He mentioned several things. He mentioned the Halabja massacre in Iraq, which you'll hear my response to later on in this broadcast. One thing I did not respond to at the UN, so I wanted to respond to now, which is what he said about Ghouta in 2013, this claim he made that Syria was guilty of a chemical attack in Ghouta in 2013. Well, if you've seen my reporting on this at the Gray Zone, you'll know that this allegation is very much contested. It's contested by leaks from inside the U.S., where Obama administration officials, back when Obama was considering bombing Syria over the Ghouta allegation, and officials from the Obama administration leaked claims that the intelligence that was supposedly produced to assert that Syria was guilty was not very solid. And in fact, the term they used was that this was not a slam dunk. And that was a deliberate reference to the claims of George Tenet back when he was the director of the CIA, when he came to George W. Bush and said, the intelligence about Iraq WMDs is a slam dunk. In Syria, Obama administration officials leaked the fact that it was not a slam dunk. And that was a very carefully chosen term. And among the officials to use that term was none other than James Clapper, who is the director of national intelligence under Obama. He came to Obama and said to him that the intelligence is not a slam dunk. And that was an obvious way of saying that the intelligence about Assad's supposed guilt was just not there. And that's why, as Seymour Hersh later reported, Obama did not bomb Syria, because he was told by his top officials that the case against Syria was not very strong, among other reasons, which Hersh detailed in his reporting. So that is my response to Thomas Phipps when it comes to the Ghouta allegation. Let's get to the issue at hand, which is the Douma allegation of April 2018. And in his comments, the British diplomat Thomas Phipps took issue with what I said.
Mr. Marty made various claims today in this meeting, one of which he focused on at length, was the issue of foaming at the mouth and whether or not it can be caused by chlorine. He said quite clearly that the IIT does not address this issue in its report. That's simply not true. It's not true. It does so directly on page 43 of the report under section 6.106. And I encourage you to also, look online, look at the very clear attempts and successful attempts that have been made to counter the claims that Mr. Marte continues to make.
So that was UK diplomat Thomas Phipps pointing to apparently some online information that he says rebuts my reporting when it comes to Douma, and also issuing a specific challenge to me to my claims about the recent OPCW IIT report not addressing the issue of whether or not the foaming seen in victims in Douma is consistent with chlorine gas. So I responded to Thomas Phipps when I got the chance to speak after him.
I want to note that in the responses from states, including the U.S. and U.K., that no one disputed the central claim of my remarks today, which was that the findings of the Duma probe were suppressed, censored. Now, I'm not here to pass any moral judgments, but I just want to note the fact that we have member states who do not contest the documented fact that the Duma findings were suppressed, but yet they oppose any action to address this suppression. And on that note, I'll also point out that I asked a question of these delegations, the U.S., U.K., and France. I mistakenly asked Germany, but they're not here, whether or not they will support the call of distinguished diplomats like the first director general of the OPCW, José Bustani, and former senior U.N. official Hans von Sponeck, to simply have the OPCW meet with all of the original members of the Duma team and let them, not just the two dissenting inspectors, but all the original members of the Duma team, let them discuss their concerns and let them put forth the evidence that was suppressed. I never got an answer back to that question, which I've now asked several times. What I did get from the representative of the UK was a substantive challenge on one issue, which I appreciate him raising. Unfortunately, he has left the room, so he's not here anymore to hear my response, which is unfortunate because I think he could benefit from hearing my answer. Now, he pointed out that the IIT report, and he said it's on page 43, paragraph 6.106, he pointed out that he argued that the IIT does address the issue of whether foaming is consistent with chlorine gas. Profuse rapid foaming, as observed and reported in Duma, is consistent with chlorine gas. And he says that the IIT did address that issue. I point out two things in response. First of all, my argument was that the IIT's toxicologist does not issue a judgment on whether or not the symptoms, including profuse foaming seen in Duma, are consistent with chlorine gas. The IIT's toxicologist does not. Now, there is a reference, which the representative from the UK pointed to, of the IIT making a claim about chlorine gas and foaming, not specific to Duma, not assessing whether those specific symptoms in Duma are consistent, but the IIT does make one reference, which I will read. This was the paragraph he referred me to. It says this: the IIT also notes that as chlorine gas reacts with the cells and moisture in the gastrointestinal tract to produce acids, that reaction also leads to the oral and nasal secretion of a foam-like substance, which may or may not have a pink tint believed to be blood. Let's assume, although they don't state it, let's assume that they are trying to say here that this passage applies to what happened in Duma. Well, turning to the footnote for this claim, which is in the IIT report, it's a study called Chlorine Gas Inhalation, Human Clinical Evidence of Toxicity and Experience in Animal Models. Now, I have that study. I've produced it. And it's unfortunate that the British representative is not here for me to tell him that the source that is adduced by the IIT for that claim about a foam-like substance contains no reference to a foam-like substance whatsoever. There's no mention of the word foam. There's no mention of the word secretion, no mention of frothing. There is nothing in the source provided by the IIT to support its claim that chlorine gas can produce a foam-like substance. And again, the issue here is not just whether chlorine gas can produce foaming. It's whether it can produce it rapidly, because the circumstances of the Duma incident, according to the official IIT narrative, is that the Duma victims died within minutes because they were overcome by a toxic chlorine gas. So accordingly, the foaming would have to have occurred within minutes as well, and that's also what some alleged witnesses have reported. So the IIT's own source does not support its claim because, again, in the study that is provided here by the IIT in that footnote, there's no mention of foaming whatsoever. This underscores my point that no one has challenged the findings of the original German toxicologists who found that the reported and observed symptoms of profuse rapid foaming in the Duma victims is consistent with chlorine gas. It underscores another point that I made, which is that this is not the domain of journalists and representatives of governments that bomb Syria. This should be dealt with by scientists. And in this case, we have the actual scientists who produced the original report, whose findings were censored. And those censored findings include the findings of the German toxicologist who said there was no consistency between the symptoms in Duma and the use of chlorine gas.
just to be clear, in response to the British diplomat, no one is saying that chlorine gas cannot cause foaming. The question is, do the circumstances of how the foaming allegedly developed in Douma, are those consistent with chlorine gas? And according to every expert who's weighed in on this, they have not. And the OPCW's new IIT report does not contradict them. As I just talked about in a new article I published at thegrayzone.com, the IIT basically avoids this question entirely. And the example he tried to give me, where he's pointing out that a part of the IIT report says that chlorine gas can cause foaming, it doesn't address the core question of whether or not chlorine gas can cause rapid death and rapid foaming. And the answer given by the German toxicologists was unequivocally no, and that's presumably why they were censored, and that's presumably why nobody, including the IIT's new toxicologist, has contradicted them. And that was the point of my remarks there. Now, earlier, the UK representative, Phibbs, also invoked the Halabja massacre committed by Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And I had something to say about that, too. So here was my response to him on that.
The representative of the UK also referenced the Halabja massacre in Iraq, where Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons against Kurds in a horrific attack. What he did not mention is that when Saddam Hussein committed that atrocity, he was supported in it by the U.S., who were an ally of Saddam Hussein, actually gave him material to carry out chemical attacks. And in the aftermath of that attack, and this is relevant to this history, the U.S. falsely accused Iran of committing out the Halabja massacre, shielding their ally, Saddam Hussein, at that time. So there is a history here of certain member states falsely accusing other member states of committing chemical attacks in order to shield the real perpetrators.
So that was my response to the UK representative, Thomas Phibbs. Now, after all this happened, I pointed out on Twitter that he had claimed in comments directed at his colleagues that they should all go online and look at what he called very clear and very successful attempts to rebut my claims about Douma. But he didn't offer any examples in his comments. And after he spoke, he actually left the room, so he wasn't around to provide any more details. So on Twitter, I challenged him to provide some examples of these supposed online articles that have rebutted me. And I encouraged him to share them on Twitter, since he didn't at the UN. He responded to me by citing an article by Bellingcat that doesn't address a single claim I've ever made. It doesn't even mention me. And he overlooked the fact that Bellingcat, which is a state-affiliated outlet of the UK, his own government, in leaked documents by a UK contractor working for the British government, this UK contractor called Bellingcat somewhat discredited for spreading a disinformation, which is an assessment I happen to agree with, because I've exposed Bellingcat's disinformation before, notably when they put out a fake claim about an OPCW whistleblower and claiming he was sent a letter that disproved his grievances. And I pointed out that not only was this letter never sent, it didn't prove anything in that rebuts him at all. So, and then he cited a thread by somebody on Twitter who constantly replies to everything I say. So those are his examples of rebuttals to me. Bellingcat, which is a state-affiliated website, and a Twitter thread. People can judge for themselves whether or not that is sufficient in rebutting all the reporting I've done, including now more than a dozen articles. So that was my exchange with the British representative, Thomas Phibbs. It was, I think, very illuminating. I think it, as I said, it underscores my point that really, rather than having me debate the question of chlorine gas and foaming with a representative of the British government, neither of us being scientists, this is a matter that should be left up to the actual OPCW scientists. But because the OPCW has suppressed its scientists' findings and won't let its own scientists now air their findings, that's why this issue now is playing out in the public domain. And I personally am grateful, at least, that if we're not going to have accountability at the OPCW, at least we're going to have this type of discussion in public. We'll leave it there for now, and I'll see you next time here on Pushback. Thanks for joining me.